welcome to the Voice of the Winged Ox, the official podcast of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Jamestown, New York. I'm your host, Rev Merrill, bringing you This I Believe. In today's world, many of the conflicts we see are shaped, at least in part, by religion. Differences between religions, and even within religions, cause a variety of problems at home and abroad. Here at St. Luke's, we are exploring our own core beliefs as Christians and Episcopalians. Listen in as we ask ourselves how our beliefs shape our values and our actions. In this podcast, we will hear from a variety of people about the intersection of their faith and life.
This is the St. Luke's Adult Forum for Sunday, October 28th, a continuation of our series for This I Believe, and our presenter this morning is Kimberly Butler.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being interested in what I have to say. I should first start off by telling you that I have put thought into this time and time again, but I came to the conclusion that too much thought wasn't worth the time and effort. So my best bet was to just come and talk. So if it sounds like I'm not making any sense or I'm rambling, just let me know. But I wanted
to... Jim will let you know.
I think I should start by just telling you kind of where I came from and where I started. And I'm from Jamestown. This is where I've always grown up. And I was born in 1967, and my parents at the time, at least my mother and her parents, were Catholic. So I was born into a technically Catholic family. My father was not Catholic, but that's the denomination that we followed. Unfortunately, my father had been married one time prior to my mother, and I was born in the late 60s, so... If you're not familiar with the Catholic Church, my dad wasn't exactly accepted there, nor was my mother after she married my father. So my parents did not ever really take me to church. My grandmother did. And it was my mother's mother. And I spent a lot of time with my grandparents when I was a young kid. My mom ended up having four children. I was her oldest, and then I had a sister 2 years younger than myself. And then 6 years after that, she had twins. So she was only 21 when I was born, so she was fairly young, and she was an only child. She was the only child of my grandparents, so we got a lot of attention. And I had a wonderful childhood spending it with my grandmother, who is the one that used to take me to church. So as I got older, she would always take me. We'd go between Sacred Heart, which was kind of her home base, and St. Pete's. You know, we'd sneak down there on Saturday afternoon services every now and then, because my grandfather also didn't go to church. He dropped us off. And then he went and sat at the library and read the evening newspaper. So Grandpa never came with us. It was always Nani and myself, and occasionally one of my other siblings. Now, I was baptized immediately, as Catholics generally do in the Catholic Church, at 3 weeks old. And then I made my first communion when I was in second grade. And my parents were always part of all of that. And I, at that time... Again, like we don't do now, could receive catechism classes during school time. We used to take the little bus from school right to the church and go for the classes on Friday afternoons. So I was able to do my first communion when I was in second grade. And then as time went on, my grandmother got sick. She'd had a slight stroke when they were away seeing family. And then once she came back home, she was never quite, you know, back to herself. And that was my only connection to church. You know, my mom and dad didn't go regularly, just my grandmother. So when I was 12 years old, and that was 28 years ago yesterday, No, it's not my birthday. But it was 28 years ago yesterday when I was 12 years old that I came home from school on a Tuesday afternoon and my mother told me my grandmother died. She'd been in the hospital and we'd went and visited and, you know, done our usual thing. And she had passed away. My parents were with her at the hospital. And that was the first real death I'd ever experienced. And unfortunately, along with her death, came the death of me going to church because there was nobody left to take me to church. So my grandparents used to, we had to take care of my grandpa. You know, I had a grandfather that grandma did everything for. So once my grandmother passed away, we moved grandpa close to us, and we all kind of took care of him. We all took turns. Oh, they're okay. So for a long time, I had a long break, I guess, in time I spent at church. Her death was extremely difficult for me. There's always those markers in your life that change your life. That was one. You know, you're just not the same person anymore. So, and you know, you're 12 years old, so it's that really tough time anyway. And I was saying to some friends last night, one of the things I remember the most about her dying was I was afraid to cry. I was afraid to do that in front of people. You know, I was very self-conscious of that. Thus, I restrained so hard that my face literally hurt for days from fighting back crying. But I was fortunate enough to live on Chautauqua Lake. So I was old enough to just take my walks down to the lake and go have my own private time. And then nobody was around, so I didn't have to worry about it. So unfortunately, because I never made it to my confirmation, she passed away before I was old enough to do that, I really never had the chance for the rest of my teenage years to go back to church. And so, you know, I muddled through and did fine. I really, you know, I had a great childhood. You know, I really did. I didn't come from all kinds of money. My parents worked hard. There was four kids, and it took a lot to give us everything that we needed. And, you know, we didn't have a huge big house, and we didn't have brand new cars, but we certainly had great Christmases and, you know, everything that we needed, you know, and we relied on each other. So what my grandmother was able to do for me was start my faith journey, which has just continued from there. And for years, people have told me that I seem different than my other siblings. You know, we all went to the same school. We all, you know many of the same people, but there's always been a difference with me versus the other ones that nobody has ever been able to pinpoint. And I've always taken it back to the time I went to church with my grandmother. And I honestly believe that those early years are what formed who I am and formed my personality and the way I look at things. And I think most of you know me fairly well, and I tend to be pretty upbeat and positive and a go-getter for the most point. And I just think that those first years are what instilled that in me. Now, along with that, you know, obviously we don't practice the Catholic religion these days. And with that, unfortunately, came the typical fear and guilt that that denomination tends to instill in people, of which, for years, I walked around and still do. I'll be the first to tell you I feel guilty for things that I was nowhere near. Had nothing to do with. And I also blame that on the, you know, that guilt factor that was instilled in me when I was a child, because that's just how things worked back then. And the fear factor, And the fear factor part of it, unfortunately, instilled a fear of God in me instead of an embrace of God. So for many of my teenage years when I was walking around, you know, I was a good kid. I made good choices. I did things the way that they should be done. I still tend to go by the book and do things the way they should be done. And I know that a big part of that was that whole fear aspect. But looking back, I so wish it would have been done differently. Because I've come to realize now that that's not a fearful thing. We shouldn't be living in fear of God. So those are the two things that I took away. I wish I didn't, to the extent that I did. But they're still in the back of my mind, and it's still okay. So then I got to be in my 20s, and my dad had joined this church, actually, when I was fairly young. And he used to bring my youngest brother and sister here. And they acolyted, and they did all those things, you know, back in the 80s and the early 90s. But this wasn't where I belonged. This wasn't what I knew. This wasn't the Catholic Church that I grew up in. And I was old enough where I was working and going to college and doing all those things that take up all your time that shouldn't, but do anyway. So I never would really come with them. And then I got to be in my 20s, and my dad was coming by himself. And I thought, you know, there's just something not right with that. Many of you might know who my mother is. You never see her here. And unfortunately, because of what transpired with her way back in the 60s when she married my dad, she's never really found her way back to a church on any kind of a regular basis. But it was important enough to my father that he came here because first he had friends that came here. So he came to this church because he knew somebody. And this was as close as he could get to what my mother had known without being able to get to that. So he would come on his own all the time. He would come by himself. The twins were old enough now. They weren't coming with him anymore. So finally, one Sunday, I said, you know what? I'm off this weekend. I'll go to church with you. So I slowly started to come back. And I started to come back on a semi-regular basis. I worked every other weekend. So the weekends I was off, I'd try and come to church with him. And kind of found my way back in my early to mid-20s. I'd been gone for a long time. I mean, I technically had been gone since I was 12 years old. At least physically in a church. Faith was still there, but I wasn't physically going and doing anything about it. So then, you have all the, you know, interesting things in life that happen to you. And unfortunately, I had become engaged to somebody I shouldn't have become engaged to. And had the wherewithal to realize that and was able to end that engagement. And at that time, thought, oh, what a traumatic experience. And, you know, kept coming to church with my dad on a regular basis and worked my way through that. And then I was able to finally meet my husband, who also grew up in the Catholic Church. We both were from different churches within the Catholic community, but both Catholic. He wasn't going to church either for some of the same reasons I wasn't. So we started to come to St. Luke's. And then it didn't take us long to realize we wanted to get married, so we wanted to get married someplace, obviously, and this was the place that I had my heart set on to do that. So we ended up here and married in 1996, and we've been here ever since. Now, back when we got married, was my faith where it should have been? Absolutely not. And I feel like it just grows all the time. When I was 2 years old, I was diagnosed with what's called leg Perthes disease. Many people see that I limp. Unfortunately, my limp isn't, you know, strictly related to that right now because I have a bad knee. But I was diagnosed with this leg disease, which means I basically do not have a whole hip on one side. So I was followed by orthopedists for years, and the plan was to put a new hip in for me when I was full grown. And I dealt with a doctor out of Buffalo, and we would go up to Buffalo all the time. And when I was about 13 is when they were going to go in and put this hip in. Well, I got an ear infection, had to be on antibiotics, and I couldn't have surgery because they wouldn't give me the anesthesia. So the surgery ended up canceled. And the doctor said, well, we might as well wait till she's an adult. You know, she's not having a lot of trouble. Let's put it off until then. Well, I turned 40 in July, and I still haven't done it. And not because I chose not to, because there was no need. And, you know, growing up as a kid, it was tough because I was restricted from gym. I had to use crutches for a long period of time. I would get really disgusted because, obviously, it brought attention to me I didn't want. At one point, my parents will tell you they had to replace the bedroom window because the crutches went flying through them.
Mm-hmm. All by themselves.
Yep. All by themselves. And it wasn't even my bedroom. It was one of my siblings' bedroom windows. So I grew up with this hip disease. That's all I knew. And, you know, I had issues from when I was a little kid. But when you grow up with that, you know, you have two choices. Either accept it or you don't. And I did, for the most part. And I didn't let it slow me down. You know, and I had a very overprotective mother who would always say, you shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be doing that, and you need to get off that leg, and you need to, you know. But I really believe it was the activity that I did do that kept it to the point where I didn't need to have things done that technically I should have. And I had male friends back then who also have it. This is something that's more prevalent in males than females. So it was an unusual thing for me to have to begin with. And suffering far more than myself. I mean, having far more trouble than I was having. And I always consider myself so fortunate and blessed that it wasn't more extensive than what it was. And I've never been a small person. You know, that should play a part in it as well. But nonetheless, never slowed me down, and I was able to just keep on going and do what I wanted to do. I've always been very active. I've never restricted myself from anything. So I always looked at that as a blessing instead of a hindrance of any sort. And then as I got older through my life, I realized different things. For example, the engagement I told you that didn't work out. And what a blessing that turned out to be. Because that wasn't who I was meant to be with. And because I had the opportunity to go through that core engagement, I was able to so much more appreciate the person I was meant to be with. So out of that bad came some really good. You know, and I thought, boy, I never would have appreciated what I had if I had not gone through that first. And then, of course, we had our children. It was not easy for us to have our children. We had Cassandra fairly early in our marriage. Nightmare of a pregnancy. I was still working full-time. I used to work as a mental health counselor, and at 18 weeks, they pulled me out of work because my blood pressure was sky high, and put me on bed rest, put me on the absolute highest dose of medication they could put me on to keep the baby safe, and all I did was sleep for the end of the pregnancy because the medicine made you so unbelievably tired. Well worth the effort I had to put in. Cassie was only born 3 weeks early. She was only a peanut, but she was a healthy peanut. She was 5'11 and a half at 3 weeks early, and unbelievably grateful and blessed that we were able to end up with such a beautiful little girl with such a horrendous pregnancy. And again, I don't think that those things just happen on their own. I honestly believe that my own faith in God and my faith in He'll do what's best for whomever at the time will get us through that. And we got through it. We got through it beautifully. And then, at the time, I decided I needed to be a stay-at-home mom. That's what worked for me. We were in a position for me to do that. So I chose to walk away from my job and become a full-time mom and still work on an occasional basis, which worked out very nice because if I wanted to work 4 days a week, I could. If I don't want to work at all during the week, I could say no. And I was able to do that for an entire year and a half. And then it became 1998 when WCA did away with all of that because of the financial issues they had. So then it was either go back on a more permanent basis or walk away entirely. And they were nice enough to offer me a part-time position because they knew I didn't want to work full-time. But I declined. I said, it's not fair to you. We'd like to have more children, and we know what happened the last time. So I didn't want to make a commitment and not be able to fulfill that. So I chose to walk away from work entirely. And within a month, the opportunity to return to college to get my master's degree in education surfaced. Just out of nowhere. Nothing I was looking for, nothing I was planning on, just surfaced. So I went with that. A friend of mine and I both went. We drove together, and I started my master's degree in education. Obviously to teach. For years, something I always thought I'd really like to do, but I thought, there's no way I could know anything well enough to teach it. And I always felt held back to do that. So I started Mercyhurst in 1998 in November, And we were going to be trying again to have another baby. And we did. And in February of 99, we found out we were pregnant. Unfortunately, it was an ectopic pregnancy. So it was in a fallopian tube instead of where it should be, and therefore was not going to turn into any kind of a normal pregnancy. By the oddest, strangest coincidence, I just said to my husband, something's just not right. I think I need to call the doctor. Something just isn't right. You know, I was taking these home pregnancy tests. They weren't telling me what I thought they should be telling me. Something just wasn't right. So it was a Monday, and I called my doctor, and she says, why don't you come in? We'll do a blood test. And so I did. And they told me, you know, from Cassie's pregnancy, you know, if you think you might be pregnant, get in and see us because you have a hard time. So I did, and sure enough, the blood test verified that we were pregnant, but my levels weren't moving, and they weren't going up. So my wonderful doctor kept having me come in and having them checked and having them checked, and then he finally said, they thought it was an ectopic pregnancy. They were thinking it was in the tube, but they would most likely check there first, and if it wasn't, they'd have to do exploratory surgery till they found it. Well, here I had my daughter by cesarean section, first surgery I'd ever had in my entire life. No anesthesia. I was wide awake. You know, I didn't have any of that stuff. So the idea of this surgery scared me to death. Here I had a baby by C-section, but this scared me to death. So my doctor said to me, there's a new treatment out there. I've only done it once, and it didn't work. But you are in the perfect window to try this. And if you're willing to try it, I'm willing to do it. And it would prevent any kind of surgery or any problems that you would have. So I said, give it a shot. What it turned out to be was a medication called methotrexate, which is a form of chemotherapy that can only be given in up to 2 doses by shot, with the goal being to dissolve what is stuck in that tube. And so I said, go ahead. He gave me the first shot. I did require the second shot, but it worked. And I didn't require any surgery, no exploratory anything, nothing. And I thought, oh my gosh, because I knew had I had to go through all of that, there wouldn't have been any more kids for Cassie. Because I thought, boy, no way am I going to risk that and do it again. It worked. It worked beautifully and took care of everything. And how fortunate was I to have a progressive enough doctor who knew about it first off and who had tried it one time and was honest with me and told me it didn't work. But something just said to me, go see the doctor. Something's not quite right. Had I not done that, the growth would have probably exploded the fallopian tube, which happens in most ectopic pregnancies, and I would have lost all of that. It was just another example of, I don't feel like that was me guiding that. I think it was my faith and, you know, something higher than me giving me the direction I needed to have. So needless to say, several months later, we were pregnant again. So they said, boy, this time, you get in here immediately if you think you're pregnant again. Because now I'd had this ectopic mess. Now we had the high blood pressure, the ectopic stuff. What are we going to have happen next? So I went to the doctor at 6 weeks. They said, yep, everything's okay, but we want you to come back in 1 week just to make sure. So I did. I went back 1 week later. And she's doing my sonogram to make sure everything's where it needs to be. And she looked at me and she said, were you on fertility drugs? I said, no. Well, I had the wherewithal to know what that meant. So she said, let me go get your husband. He's out in the waiting room. And then she proceeded to tell us that we were having twins. And my first stop was my mother's house. I said to my husband, drive me over to my mother. I said to my mother, how am I having twins? You had twins. Aren't my kids supposed to have the twins? Why am I having twins? But that same very day, when they told me they were having the twins, they sent me right back upstairs to one of the other doctor's offices and sat us in front of his desk. And he proceeded to tell us, oh my gosh, you're going to have to go to Buffalo. This is going to be the most high-risk pregnancy. You're going to have this, that, and the other thing because I had all these problems with Cassandra. And Jim and I were both sitting there, and I looked at the doctor, and I said, we will be just fine. And those babies were born at 37 weeks. They were 6'1 and 6'2 and a half. Bigger than my daughter, both of them. Bigger than my single birth daughter. And came home with me the day I went home from the hospital. We required nothing for lung development. They kept telling me, you're going to have to take this medication, develop their lungs, so if they come early. And I said, I just don't think I have to do that. They required nothing. I had no high blood pressure. They assured me I'd be diabetic. I had no diabetes. I had no anything. So I was able to bring those boys home with me 5 days later, after another C-section. Perfectly fine. And again, I don't just attribute that to luck or coincidence. You know, another example of how faith has grown. So then you fast forward to 2002, when Jimmy started to have his issues. He had been sick over Christmas. And I'd taken him to his pediatrician, and the pediatrician diagnosed him with pneumonia, put him on antibiotics. Well, it got to be January 2nd, and he wasn't any better. And now he was throwing phlegm up and all this stuff. And I called the doctor back. I said, something's wrong here. So I called my husband on the way to the doctor's office, and I said, you better meet me at the doctor's office. Something's not right. So we took him to our pediatrician, and they had done blood work. And all of his blood work was goofy. His white blood cells, his red blood cells, his platelets especially, were a big concern. Nothing was running the way it should be. So the pediatrician sent us right to Buffalo Children's. He said, go home, throw some clothes in a bag. They're expecting you in the emergency room. They're admitting him. So here I am with this not quite two-year-old, a twin to the two-year-old and our five-year-old daughter, trying to make arrangements in January to take this kid to Buffalo. So Jim and I get him up there, and he was admitted, and he was actually tested for RSV, which is what he actually had. He did not have pneumonia. He had the RSV virus, which was just coming out back when he was that age. So they diagnosed him with that, which is a virus, and you can't take antibiotics for. So he had to just work his way through the viral thing and run the fevers and whatever came of that. Well, in the meantime, we were hooked up with a hematologist, which is a blood doctor in Buffalo, to go over all these blood results for him. And they kept checking them and kept checking them, and they weren't going anywhere. They weren't going up. So they decided that they really needed to do a bone marrow biopsy to see what was going on. So that was scheduled for January 22nd at Buffalo Children's. Father Eric spent the day with us there. So we went up and we had the bone marrow biopsy. Up to this point in my life, the hardest day of my life. And the doctor came out with us there and informed us that Jimmy's bone marrow was just as healthy as his own. At the time, they were checking him for leukemia. And he was so sickly. I mean, he looked terrible. He had this RSV. He looked absolutely terrible. He had no color. He was just... You know, you would have thought for sure that that's what he had. So they proceeded to tell us that his bone marrow was fine, and they sent us back home, and we just checked with our regular doctor on a regular basis. So we continued to do that, and we take him every year and get his blood work with his well checkup and all the stuff that you do. The result he did have is he's always had ITP, which is low platelets. They stay in a safe enough range for Jimmy, but they're not considered anywhere near where they should be. His run about 50 to 60,000 generally. You should have 150 to 450,000. But the doctors felt he was safe enough, you know, and he was, you know, taking care of himself. We'd watch him, make sure he bruises easier than most kids. So all went along just fine until September 10th of this year. Now, I can tell you that back in 2002, when we were dealing with all of this with Jimmy, there's a whole 6 weeks I don't even remember. I can honestly tell you, I don't remember hardly anything from that 6 weeks. I was so wrapped up in the worry. And what's going to happen to my son? I couldn't function. I couldn't think. Thank God I was a stay-at-home mom. No way I could have worked a job. Absolutely not. And where I have come from then to now is amazing. Now, I can tell you that because we went to the doctor on September 10th, and we're right back in the same boat again. Doctor comes out. I'm thinking, I work today. I'm taking the kids for their physical. We're going to go home, do this tonight. Doctor comes in and says, you're going to Buffalo Children's. All his blood work's goofy again. Everything's out of whack, just like it was all those years ago. Now, keep in mind, all those years ago, I said to this doctor, could he develop leukemia from this? Absolutely not. So I thought, well, you know, we're fine. You know, he runs his low platelets, but they stay healthy. We can manage that. It could be far worse. So Monday, September 10th, we were back at Children's Hospital till 1:30 in the morning, having another pediatric hematologist look at him because our previous one has left Buffalo Children's. Can't imagine why. So we now have this new young doctor. And very thorough, a very young guy who says, you know, went right back to when Jimmy was born and told us. He said, his red blood cells have been large since he was born. He looked back in the blood work as a newborn and then followed everything all the way up. And his red blood cells have always run a little bit low, sometimes more so than others, but usually just a hair lower than what the normal range is. And so he said, I think we need to do another bone marrow biopsy. So September 19th, we had a second bone marrow biopsy done. And my understanding is he had the results of the first and could compare the two. So they were very thorough and checked my son for anything and everything that you can imagine. Things I've never even heard of. The list was unbelievable. It took weeks for them to go through all this and get back to us. And then they called me up and told me the results of the biopsy were nonspecific. I said, well, what's that mean? You know, what's nonspecific? So he says, well, I'm sending it for another opinion. So that took another week or 10 days. And he sent it off for another opinion. So then we finally went up there October 11th and had our appointment with the doctor, and who then informed us that they have ruled everything on this list out. Absolutely everything that they were checking for. He has none of what they were checking for. So there's only one thing left, which is this syndrome called MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome. Unbelievably rare in children. Basically, your bone marrow wears out like an old car and doesn't do what it should do. And he said, by means of exclusion, because there's really no way to diagnose this MDS, this is all we have left. So this is what it must be. Not with 100% certainty, because there is no 100% certainty. So what that translates to is that he doesn't have leukemia, he doesn't have aplastic anemia, but he's virtually guaranteed to develop it if we don't do something about this MDS. So they've informed us that our best option is a bone marrow transplant. So we've went from chronic ITP, which was totally doable, to just overnight needing a bone marrow transplant for a kid that's as active as any of my other kids and then some. You know, the one that's the first one up every day and the last one to bed for the most part. And certainly doesn't look the part. It's been an unbelievable amount to absorb in the last 2 months. But when I look at where I was in 2002 to where I am now, I go to work every day and I actually get something done. And our life is actually pretty normal for the most part as we wait and figure out what it is that we need to do. I didn't have that ability 6 years ago. And that ability came from here, from God, in my own growth, that God said somewhere, get your act together and let's get this show on the road. You're going to need this somewhere along the line. And it's amazing to me the transformation that I've had. So, here I stand today. I'm your poster girl for vulnerability. And I promised I wouldn't cry.
All right.
Why not?
I was thrilled myself when Passionate Spirituality got chosen here. Because I really, really think that was an awesome choice for us. And I know what a struggle this whole vulnerability portion of that Passionate Spirituality is and will be. But I just so believe that that's a struggle that we need to take on. Because the reason I continue to do this, I could have said to Father Eric, I could have said to Barb, forget it, I'm not getting up there and talking in front of those people. I don't think I'm doing myself a service, and I don't think I'm doing any of you a service by doing that. We had a choice. We could keep all of this to ourselves and do all this on our own, or we could put ourselves out there and let people know what we were dealing with. And let me tell you what, the response is unbelievable. I have strangers coming up on the street offering me their bone marrow. Do we need to get tested? Can we go get tested somewhere to see if we're a match? Does he need a match? I mean, people we don't even know offering us those things. It's unbelievable what people are capable of when they know that there's something they should step up to. And by not choosing to look at that vulnerability point, we're depriving ourselves of so much. So much. You know, we come here week after week after week. If we can't rely on one another to help get through stuff, what do we have? You know, and you know what? For the most part, I consider myself a really strong person. You know, life is tough right now. And I don't consider myself any less of a person for being up here in front of you telling you that. Because if it makes one of your lives a little bit easier because one goofy thing that went wrong that's been ripping you apart isn't so important anymore, then it did something good. You know, if my way of coping with things somehow helps somebody else in the same predicament, then it did some good. And that's one of the things I so hope to see grow in this church. It's all right to ask for help. It's all right to not be strong all the time and actually need the people that you sit in the pews with every single week. I don't think there's any shame in that. I don't think there's anything to not be proud of in that. You know, I think that makes me a stronger person. Because what good are all these people around us if we don't tap into what they have to offer us and what good that they can do? I realize that this whole vulnerability idea is a really tough thing. But I'm a member of your vestry, and I will tell you right now, it doesn't get any more vulnerable than this. I could stand up here with an illness for myself easier than I can stand up here with an illness for my son. So I think we're on the right track, and I think we shouldn't get away from that track. It can only make the church as a whole a stronger church. It can only make Jim and myself and our other children stronger people. There's no shame in showing people we're going through a tough time. We've got a lot of pain right now. That's what I want my kids to see. I don't want my kids hurting for days because they were afraid to cry in public like I was. I don't want them to do that. I don't want what we're going through with my son to identify my three kids. I don't want this to be what identifies them for the rest of their life. I don't want this to be that one episode that you never get over and you get stuck with forever. So if we encourage them to talk about it, and it won't be just to us, we encourage them to talk about it to other people. Because they're afraid to talk to us. You know, they'll talk to other people and say, you know, we're really worried about this, or we're afraid of this. You know, we go tomorrow morning to have our other two children tested to see if they're a match for our third. And we hope to God that one of them is. And then, when that happens, two of them are laying there. Not just one. So when you go home today, my assignment for you is to honestly pray about what we've chosen to do here. Pray about the whole vulnerability component. I can't tell you how important that is and what a difference we could make. Not just for other people, but for ourselves.
You can visit us online at thewingedox.blogspot.com, where you can find more information, show notes, and links to resources mentioned in these podcasts. You can also call our comment line at 206-203-3904 or send us email at thewingedox@gmail.com. Our music is The First Sunday by Jeff Wall, available at magnatune.com. For the voice of the Winged Ox, I'm your host, Rev Merrill. May God bless your week.